When Abraham Lincoln entered the White House in 1861, five of its former residents, Martin Van Buren, John Tyler, Milla Fillmore, Franklin Pierce, and James Buchanan, were still alive, although they had been unable to resolve the issues of slavery and national unity during their own presidencies. They all watched Lincoln's struggle to save the Union during the Civil War with critical eyes. In his book, The President's War, Six American Presidents and the Civil War That Divided Them, constitutional law professor and political strategist Chris DeRose describes how Lincoln managed to preserve the Union, abolish slavery, without the support of his predecessors. It's published by Lyons Books, Lyons Press, I guess, and I'm very pleased that it brings Chris DeRose to our show today. Hello.
Hi, how you doing? Thanks for having me.
Now, President Obama has four living ex-presidents. Was five former presidents the most?
Five former presidents is the record. It was the record then, and it remained the record until the modern era. We've had it twice, but there's never been six.
Had all of the former presidents remained politically active?
They had. You see, there's this tradition, right? George Washington sets the precedent for what the president does, and he also set the precedent for what the president does in retirement, which is you go home to your farm and you stay out of public life and you let your successor do their job without interference from you. So they were intensely interested in politics, but they were following this maxim of staying out of it.
But hadn't John Quincy Adams gone back into politics?
Yeah, he was certainly an exception to the rule. He went and spent many years in the Congress. In fact, served in Congress with Abraham Lincoln for a time.
Hasn't President Obama had to contend with criticism from some of his predecessors, including Bill Clinton on occasion? Also, Jimmy Carter says Obama never calls him to ask for his opinion on domestic and international matters.
I can't imagine why.
Did Lincoln seek advice from any of the five?
He did not. He made a show in the run-up to his presidency of seeking the advice of Millard Fillmore. And I think the reason for that is that Fillmore had run as a third-party candidate in 1856. He'd gotten over 20% of the vote. He was really popular in the border states that Lincoln would need to hold on to. So he made a big show of courting Millard Fillmore publicly, but he never solicited their advice behind the scenes.
Fillmore offered advice about relations with Great Britain. Did Lincoln take it?
Lincoln took some of it. It was a 6-page letter. It was really remarkable. Fillmore, who had adhered to this maxim more or less of letting his successor do what he needed to do without interference, but he wrote him a 6-page letter about seeking arbitration over the Trent Affair, which almost brought Britain into the war.
Since Lincoln was the first president elected as a Republican, did he feel any connections to his predecessors?
Well, politically, he and Millard Fillmore had been allies because the Republican Party comes as a response to the Kansas-Nebraska Act, the repeal of the Missouri Compromise and the possibility of slavery on the Great Plains north of the previous line. And so Lincoln and Fillmore were part of the Whig Party together. In fact, Lincoln was a member of Congress when Fillmore was running for vice president, and Lincoln campaigned very actively for him throughout Massachusetts and the East Coast.
So he felt closer to the Whigs than he did to the Democrats, who were seen as the party of the South.
Certainly.
How would you describe Lincoln's personality? What kind of boss was he?
Lincoln was an incredible executive. For someone who assumes the presidency with so little executive experience, maybe on paper our least experienced president, at least in the formal sense. But he understood people better than anyone ever to occupy the White House. And if you can understand people, you can lead them and manage them. And often people were being led and managed by Lincoln without their knowledge.
How many states made up the Union when he took office in 1861? He'd already lost one or two?
He'd already lost seven at that point.
Seven had already seceded, starting with South Carolina?
Starting with South Carolina.
Now, South Carolina had tried to secede earlier in American history. Was this something similar?
Well, they had
threatened. Were the justifications the same?
You know, the saying with South Carolina was it's too small to be its own country, but too big for an insane asylum. And so South Carolina was a perpetual problem to the occupant of the White House throughout American history. And in 1832, they threatened to secede over the tariff, which burdened Southern agriculture but boosted Northern manufacturers.
Now, the Andrew Jackson was the president at the time. How did he respond to their call for secession?
So it was a mixed response. It was carrot and stick. Jackson went to Congress for permission to use military force against South Carolina and to enforce the federal laws in South Carolina. At the same time, John Tyler and Henry Clay worked behind the scenes at figuring out a way to reduce the tariff that was the source of South Carolina's frustration. And so you see that the force bill, which allowed the president to go to war against South Carolina, and the compromise tariff were passed and signed on the same day.
Martin Van Buren was the oldest of Lincoln's five living predecessors. He'd been Andrew Jackson's Secretary of State during that crisis, the nullification crisis.
Yeah, he was a critical member of the Jackson cabinet, and he got packed off to Great Britain. He ended up out of the cabinet in a major dispute, which saw Jackson clear out his cabinet, and Van Buren ends up coming back as Jackson's running mate in that year and is elected with him, 1832.
And then later becomes president on his own.
Yes.
What was his response to South Carolina's threat to withdraw from the Union in 1833?
So he was a Unionist. In fact, the book begins at a dinner, Jefferson Day dinner, with Jackson, his vice president, John C. Calhoun, and Van Buren each giving toasts. So Jackson says, "The Union, it must be preserved." Calhoun says, "Union's important, but next to our liberty, the most dear." South's peculiar definition of liberty. But Van Buren says, "America is a series of compromises. It's always been a compromise. And let us remember that we can compromise our way out of everything." And so that's Van Buren's perspective. Carrot and stick, compromise, find a way to get past it.
But surprisingly, at least in light of that, he tried to undermine Lincoln. Hadn't he even schemed to deny Lincoln the presidency?
He certainly did, but he was a Democrat. And so, you know, out of Lincoln's five predecessors, you have four Democrats who each support different... The Democratic Party nominated two people that year. They nominated... The Northerners nominated Stephen Douglas, and the Southerners nominated John C. Breckinridge. And so Van Buren was a Douglas guy. So no surprise that they're not supporting Lincoln. But beyond that, the five former presidents saw their role as conciliators-in-chief. They wanted to compromise. They wanted to give in to Southern bellicosity instead of standing on principle. And that's where Lincoln differed from them. They saw Lincoln as a threat to the institution.
How did James Buchanan, who was still the president in 1860 when South Carolina and the others declared their secession, how did he respond?
To the secession crisis? Mm-hmm. It's a series of stages. So when Buchanan starts, when this crisis begins, Buchanan has avowed secessionists in his cabinet. In fact, his Secretary of War is a Southerner and pro-secessionist. He starts trying to send guns to the South and out of Northern arsenals. So he's got some people who want him to stand firm and some people who want him to throw in the towel. And eventually, by the end of the crisis, he will have replaced those secessionists or they will have left. And by the end of it, he turns over to Lincoln probably the best possible situation that he could have under the circumstances.
He doesn't come across as one of the great presidents.
He's certainly one of the worst.
It's interesting that the kinds of compromises some people had to make or tried to make. Didn't Robert E. Lee ask to be transferred to California so that he could avoid being part of any possible conflict?
You know, Lee enjoyed war. I think the best we could have hoped from Lee, who was originally tendered command of the Union Army by Abraham Lincoln, or at least felt out for the possibility, if Virginia had stayed in the Union, Lee would have remained neutral. So that was the best we could have hoped for Lee. But instead, of course, he commands to great effect the Army of Northern Virginia.
My guest is Chris DeRose. His book, The President's War, Six American Presidents and the Civil War That Divided Them. Van Buren, although he had schemed to deny Lincoln the presidency, later supported him after the attack on Fort Sumter. And then he died 1 year into the presidency. So did he have much impact on Lincoln?
He did a couple of things. And, you know, it's interesting. I found this story for the first time while researching this book. There's a dinner party in this city. They're talking, you know, who is this Abraham Lincoln? We've got the secession crisis. These states are leaving the Union. We don't know anything or we know very little about this guy. And Van Buren remembered a time when he was making a comeback bid for president 20 years earlier and had met a young state legislator named Abraham Lincoln. And he said, "I was so favorably impressed with him. And I've never forgotten about him. I always expected big things out of him. And so the country's going to be fine. So during the crisis, after Fort Sumter, which Martin Van Buren was outraged by, I mean, this was their 9/11, Southern forces firing on the American flag, firing on American troops.
Was that even necessary? Was the South doing a preemptive attack?
The fort had very little strategic value. It was all very symbolic. And so
why not just secede and see what happens?
Well, so they had seceded. What happened was the secession movement lost all its steam. So Lincoln comes into office. You have this president who's firmly committed to opposing the spread of slavery. Feelings are very high. States are leaving the Union or thinking about it. But then after a couple months go by, they stopped and caught their breath and said, what are we doing? And so the government of the Confederate States of America actually launched that attack in order to draw blood, because otherwise states were getting ready to go back into the Union and drop the secession.
Texas had seceded.
Texas had.
And I don't think of Texas as being deep south. Was there much slavery in Texas?
There was. In fact, in Texas's declaration of the reasons for secession, they talked about white supremacy, how America was founded for the benefit of the white race, and that African slavery was a blessing, and that the Republican Party threatened that institution of slavery, and for those reasons they had to leave.
How was the rest of the American public viewing all of this? What do we know from newspapers and the like?
What we know is then as now, we look to our former presidents because they theoretically have the knowledge, they have the experience, they have a unique perspective, but they're no longer tainted by the need to continue to pursue political office. And so people wrote in by the dozens to these former presidents, begging them to seek some sort of solution, to find some kind of compromise. And they actually came very near to meeting as a group to try to recommend some sort of compromise.
Although President John Tyler was from Virginia, didn't he serve on the Confederate States House of Representatives after Virginia seceded?
Yeah, he absolutely did. So Tyler chairs the Peace Convention of 1861, which is the last-ditch attempt to compromise our way out of the crisis. When that fails, he goes to Virginia and actually serves in the Secession Convention, so working to draw his state out of the Union. And then when that is successfully done, he joins the Provisional Confederate Congress of the Confederate States of America. And so he is recommending the takeover of the United States Capitol. He's a working day-to-day member of the Provisional Congress.
And you're right. John Tyler was exhausting himself to undermine Lincoln.
Everything he could possibly do.
Did he have a problem with Lincoln himself, or was it just a matter of partisan politics?
It was a matter of being on the opposite sides of the issues of the day. So Tyler actually was much more stridently pro-slavery than the other former presidents.
Should we be surprised? Because Tyler told one of his sons, half the success in life depends on manners, and the first and highest conquest is for him to obtain a mastery over his passions.
Isn't that something? Tyler really was an old Virginia aristocrat, and he believed in the importance of manners and self-control.
But he didn't mind his manners when it came to Lincoln?
Well, he was unfailingly personally polite to Lincoln, but he certainly worked very, very hard politically within the political sphere to take Virginia out of the Union and ally it with the Confederates.
What about the others? Did they maintain their manners? Were they ever disrespectful?
I guess where you stand is where you sit. And I don't know if Lincoln felt disrespected, but he certainly wasn't very sensitive to those things. But when you have Franklin Pierce out on the stump calling him a tyrant, accusing him of undermining the Constitution, you have Millard Fillmore attacking him for making the war for expanding the Union war objective to include the destruction of slavery. You know, it's probably hard not to feel disrespected by your predecessor.
Well, he was disrespected by many people in general, especially in New York. There, I've seen some of the political cartoons of the time, and Lincoln is ridiculed in a way that would even be rare today in our partisan environment.
Yeah, I love hearing about how acrimonious things are now compared to what they used to be, because I think we've got nothing on politics of the antebellum era or the mid-19th century. Abraham Lincoln really loved New York City, but plenty of people in New York didn't love him. In fact, the city of New York seriously contemplated seceding and becoming an independent city because their trade with the South was so profitable.
Later, Norman Mailer suggested the same sort of thing, he and Jimmy Breslin, but for different reasons.
Yes.
Millard Fillmore said that the Union had to be maintained by force if necessary, but wasn't he also very critical of Lincoln at the same time?
So he starts out as an ardent supporter of Lincoln. After the shots on Fort Sumter, Millard Fillmore gives a speech in Buffalo encouraging people to join the Union Army and to follow President Lincoln's call for troops. Later, Lincoln will expand the objectives of the war from putting the country back together politically to putting it back together and destroying the institution of slavery. No one was more willing to go to war to save the Union than Millard Fillmore. No one was less willing to go to war to destroy slavery than Millard Fillmore.
And Buchanan, what was his response to Lincoln's attempts to preserve the Union? He probably had already fallen out of favor with the American public.
Buchanan was the subject of daily death threats delivered to his door in his retirement in Pennsylvania. He was
death threats from whom?
People throughout the country. He was hated north and south for his response to the secession crisis.
But he said he would have responded the same as Lincoln did to the attack on Fort Sumter.
He does. In fact, he makes the argument that Lincoln was simply following his policies. I guess we'll never know if Buchanan would have responded that way. Certainly one of his former cabinet members pointed out to him, you know, when South Carolina fired on the Star of the West, which was an American ship sent to reinforce Fort Sumter, resupply Fort Sumter, that could have been your casus belli. That was worse than Fort Sumter, and you didn't do a thing about it.
Now, none of these presidents are remembered as among the best ones. Is it because they weren't all that great as presidents, or did the fact that they were less than sterling during the Civil War affect the way we remember them?
It's a combination of all of those things. I think, for starters, our collective memory only permits us to remember a handful of presidents, right? Nobody's going to remember and name all 43. But it's a combination of things. Their solutions didn't stand the test of time. We ended up in a civil war where 2.5% of the country was killed. And that was as a direct and proximate result of the decisions they made or failed to make. On the other hand, they have some notable accomplishments. You know, President John Tyler opened up trade with China. That's a pretty important economic benefit to
him. He was an accidental president.
He was, for the first one.
Yeah, because Tippecanoe died and Tyler, number two, became number one.
Yes, he did.
Now, how many of them survived past the Civil War?
Three.
Did they support Andrew Johnson's policies, the policies that led to Johnson being impeached?
You know, so people really lost their appetite for continuing to maintain Reconstruction, to see that we gave black Americans more than just liberty, right? The idea that they had now been freed, the 13th Amendment was gone, there were no slaves anymore. But the idea that we're going to prevent white supremacists in the South from retaking political power and oppressing the freed blacks. People like Franklin Pierce was a white supremacist. He didn't want America to engage in the Civil War. Pierce didn't believe that there should be a military response to Fort Sumter. He thought the Confederates should be able to leave. So he was very strongly supportive of what Andrew Johnson failed to do in Reconstruction. Fillmore, same thing. He wanted the Union put back together, but he with or without slavery, it didn't matter to him.
Chris DeRose is a constitutional law professor and a political strategist, and his latest book is The President's War, Six American Presidents and the Civil War That Divided Them. It is published by Lions Press, and he will be reading at Bryant Park tonight at 7 p.m. More information on our show page at WNYC.org. Thank you so much for being with us today.
It's been a pleasure. And if your listeners want to connect with me, I'm at ChrisDeRoseBooks.com.